Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the man some call the most polarizing and controversial Supreme Court justice in American history, the story of Antonin Scalia and why no one predicted who we would become. Then, what is driving the increased violence against women in some parts of the world, and what women are doing to stop it. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's barbed remarks and offensive tactics have alienated even some of his conservative colleagues on the court. And many observers consider him the most polarizing justice in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Who is Antonin Scalia, and why did no one predict his behavior as a Supreme Court justice? With us is Bruce Allen Murphy. He is a judicial biographer and a professor of law at Lafayette College. His latest book is called Scalia, A Court of One. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Bruce Allen Murphy. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Maria. Thanks for inviting me.
Of all the justices, and I know you've been doing biographies of others as well, why Antonin Scalia specifically?
Well, it's been a journey to get to Scalia. This is my fourth judicial biography. The last one was on William O. Douglas, who was described by one of his friends, Raoul Berger, as the oddest duck who ever served on the Supreme Court. And the Douglas biography allowed me to explore the most controversial justice of that era, although he was, of course, an iconic liberal on the court. And I had been exploring through the other books on Brandeis and Frankfurter and Abe Fortas the issue of extrajudicial work by justices off the bench and the effect on the court. And when I looked for a new topic after Douglas, Scalia's name rose to the top very quickly because he's clearly the most visible, the most controversial, and possibly the smartest and most talented intellect on this court, a man who really would be fun to spend 8 years with exploring his life, and he was indeed all of that.
It's interesting you would use the word fun, given his sort of abrasive personality.
Well, you try not to get too emotionally involved with your subjects, and you hope that you pick a topic that will keep you getting out of bed in the morning and thinking, how can I advance this work a little bit farther? And I found Scalia endlessly fascinating. I kept discovering things about him that surprised me. I kept trying to predict what he would do next and trying to explain why my predictions weren't quite accurate. And he was an ideal subject for a biographer.
One of the things, speaking of prediction, is that hardly anybody could have predicted who he ended up becoming. And certainly in the early part of your book, you describe a guy who was affable. You describe a guy who, of course, liked to be the center of attention, but wasn't so offensive as he sort of turned out to be on the Supreme Court.
Absolutely true. When you do some of your preliminary research and biographical work, what you look for is journalistic pieces that cover the sweep of a person's life. If the individual is dead, then you start with the obituaries. If the individual is still living, you're going to start with the articles around the time when that person was put on the court. And I was puzzled almost immediately when I read a number of articles and a number of comments from people on all sides of the ideological spectrum predicting that once Antonin Scalia was put on the Supreme Court in 1986 by Ronald Reagan, he would become the William Brennan of the conservatives. Brennan, of course, was the wingman to Earl Warren. He was the man who brought together the liberals into the activist Supreme Court, liberal court that the Warren Court became, and it was widely anticipated by everyone that Scalia, who was described as affable, gregarious, congenial, willing to compromise, willing to hear other views, these were the words that were used by these people, that he would bring the court together. And something didn't ring true, obviously, and I couldn't believe, one, that is the impression that they had in 1986, so I had to figure out from the early life, how did they get that impression? And I would have made the same prediction based on the evidence that they had in 1986. And then I had to figure out how he became who he is now.
Well, let's start to dissect that. He was an only child, and his parents were immigrants, is that right?
It's true. And he was much more than an only child, if you can imagine that. He was the only child of his extended family's generation, which means he was also the only grandchild. So every member of his extended family, father and mother's side, doted on him. And he became used to that kind of attention, and I think it affected the way he saw the world. He was raised by an immigrant Italian father who was known as Sam Scalia. His name was actually Salvatore Eugene Scalia, a brilliant man who rose by his intellect to become a professor of Romance languages at Brooklyn College, was a very stern individual, and impressed on his son the need to be a person of considerable character. He would like to tell Antonin that muscles can be hired by the hour as an article of commerce, but character can't be sold or bought. And he was impressing upon his son the need for hard work, for scholastic effort, for academic achievement. And interestingly enough, he also had a theory called literalism. He believed that he could look at ancient Italian poets and interpret their meaning in English language by literally interpreting each of the words. So he had a theory that sort of previewed what Scalia would eventually do. And beyond that, his parents raised him in a pre-Vatican II, very traditional, very conservative Catholicism that has guided Scalia throughout his entire life.
It's a brand of Catholicism that doesn't really comport with what many Catholics hold, particularly the current pope.
And Scalia has gotten into debates with the Catholic Church in the early 21st century over the question of the death penalty. He would like to turn the clock back in the religious world to an earlier era, and he believes that the old values are the best values. When it turns out that he doesn't agree with the current pope or when he doesn't agree with the current church, he argues, well, two millennia of popes agree with me, and so I choose to follow them rather than the current church and the current pope.
He was very conservative from very early on. He was an only child, and he didn't have to learn to play well with others. He did for a while, though.
He was capable of being very nice and playing as part of a team. He was actually a very accomplished actor when he was at Xavier High School, Jesuit school in Manhattan, and later at Georgetown University. He was a fellow that the other actors could rely on. He helped to get one of his fellow actors at Xavier through the role of playing Lady Macbeth, and the fellow was being teased, and he said Nino Scalia was able to help him through that as best he could. Scalia was a very well-liked. He was always elected to leadership positions, and in Georgetown, he was known as the actor Tony Scalia. That's the way he was billed in his in the playbills. But there was another side to him. It was true at Xavier and especially true at Georgetown. Scalia, from very early age, had an ability to see the central arguments in a debate, the jugular of the argument, if you will. And at the top levels, and Scalia was maybe the best college debater in the country of his era, the top college debaters are able to really crush their opponents, almost like an intellectual chess match, and they are not adverse to using ad hominem attack. It's expected. You're given additional points for that kind of a behavior. And that character on Georgetown's campus was known as Nino Scalia. So it was sort of a battle between these two sides, and I think that the person they were discussing in 1986 who would come to the court and bring the court together was Tony Scalia. And the person who arrived, as we'll learn down the road, is Nina Scalia.
So one became dominant later in life, whereas the other side may have been more dominant in the other parts of life.
And the one true constant in this period of his education was his pre-Vatican II Catholicism. Even though he was at a Jesuit school at Georgetown, and because of his many accomplishments, he was asked to give effectively the valedictory speech. It was called the Cohonguraten speech, named for the Cohonguraten River, or the Potomac River, the River of Swans. And he made an argument that his classmates and he were the chosen few, that if they would not lead the country in the Catholic tradition, who would? And it was their obligation to be sure that others would follow in their footsteps.
That was kind of a common theme in your book, that even in his lectures as he became a professor, he ended them frequently with this idea that you cannot separate your religion from the rest of your life.
It's a constant theme throughout his own explanation of his life. That's why I opened the book with him at President Obama's second inaugural. And Claire McCaskill, who took a picture of him in his silk hat, his skull cap, in the 2008 inaugural. It was the first tweet, I think, that she made to her followers. She was waiting to see what he would wear to the second inaugural, and he showed up in this billowy sort of black velvet cap that looked almost like a popover. And when people found out where it had come from, it turned out to be a reproduction of the cap worn by Sir Thomas More, who is one of Scalia's heroes. Scalia believes that More was the saint of law, but also he is the depiction of the kind of morality and traditional Vatican, pre-Vatican II Catholicism that Scalia favors. And so when he ended his classes at the University of Chicago Law School, he would read his class, Selections from a Man for All Seasons, and encourage them to delve further into More's life.
Another common theme from your book is this idea that he didn't really want to engage in issues related to poor people. He thought that was a waste of his time, and he thought there were, in a quote that you have, more important things in life.
He's also, he's very much in line with meritocracy. He's not in favor of affirmative action. It's ironic for a man who was appointed to the court in the end by the president because he was an Italian-American. He de facto got an affirmative action hire for the Supreme Court. I think Scalia's belief is that you should pay attention to people who are achieving, and those people who are achieving will continue to be successful. Success will translate to financial reward. And so he's much more concerned about making it possible for those individuals to succeed rather than trying to create a country in which you do what you can to raise everybody up to a certain level so that they can achieve from that point.
Then he went to work for a big law firm doing defense work. Was it Jones Day?
Jones Day, which turned out to be pivotal in his life. He was working late at night as a law student on the Harvard Law Review, and a fellow from Jones Day in Cleveland went to the Law Review office looking for someone to hire and persuaded Scalia to at least come to Cleveland to visit for an interview. Scalia didn't get a job in Philadelphia or Boston or New York or Washington even, and he now says sometimes in his speeches, "Can you believe I went to Cleveland?" But it actually worked out for him. First of all, he got to be a generalist in the law, so he did all kinds of different cases and rose to the top very quickly. And a number of the people who were in that law firm became very well connected in the Republican Party. And so there was a fellow named Jonathan Rose who was able to get him appointments in the Nixon and the Ford administration. It was pivotal in Scalia's rise to power.
Let's go into some of this Nixon administration. First of all, rather than becoming a partner at Jones Day, he went on to teach instead, but then his colleagues went into the Nixon administration. How did he then end up going into the president's office?
Well, Scalia, I think, was a bit of a gypsy trying to figure out where he would end up. I think he played with the idea of being a private lawyer. I think he played with the idea of being an academic. Once he was at the University of Virginia, so close to be able to get on the train and go up to Washington, he was very interested in getting an appointment in Washington, somewhere where he could maybe be noticed and rise a little farther. Whether he at that point was thinking, well, gee, maybe one day I could be Solicitor General, or maybe one day I could be on the Supreme Court, I can't say. But at least he was trying to find his own place. He was exceedingly lucky in that he got his appointment to the Nixon administration just as the Nixon administration was going out of office. And Gerald Ford continued to keep him in the administration. He was in the Office of Legal Counsel. And one of his first jobs was to figure out whether or not the presidential papers were owned by Richard Nixon and should be controlled by Richard Nixon. And he wrote an opinion in favor of Nixon's ownership. It was not an opinion that was followed by Congress. It was not an opinion that was followed by the Supreme Court. But interestingly enough, the only justice who dissented in that case in the Supreme Court was William Rehnquist, who was also in the Office of Legal Counsel. So Scalia had a gift for saying the right thing at the right time and a kind of a star over his head that put him in the perfect position each time for advancement to a better position.
So he did advance in both of those situations. Before he even ended up in the Office of General Counsel, didn't he also do some work in the broadcast field?
I skipped over that, and it was very interesting because it showed me how Scalia was learning how to work in the political field. He was working in the Office of Telecommunications Corporation. His job was to try to advise his boss about the questions of PBS funding and cable channels and exactly how regulations could work in the new cable industry when you already had broadcast television. And Scalia was well aware in this process that he was in opposition to the Nixon administration. The Nixon administration just wanted to defund PBS and was very unhappy about the national news of the PBS that was very hostile to Nixon's Watergate episode. And so what Scalia tried to do was advise his boss how politically to try to get around what the Nixon administration was trying to do and move the entire structure back to the local channels. And when that didn't seem to work, he was able to find the legal justification to allow his boss to make those arguments.
So throughout his work with both presidencies, he became really well-liked by two key people. One is Donald Rumsfeld, one is Dick Cheney.
You could count on Antonin Scalia to do what the Ford administration and what Gerald Ford needed to have done. And what I found especially interesting, he didn't do a lot of work directly with Cheney and Rumsfeld, but they were working on the same issues in different parts of the administration. Here were three men, one much younger than the other two, who had worked their entire professional careers to get to the White House, to work with the president, and they were in a sinking administration, not through their own fault, not even through Gerald Ford's fault. This was a presidency as an institution that was greatly diminished by the Watergate episode. And so daily they were dealing with leaks to the press, and they were dealing with investigations by Congress. And I think it drove them all a little bit crazy that they had finally risen to this level of power, and they had no power. I think you find the roots there, certainly, of Scalia's affection for and determination to continue a much more powerful presidential office.
So you see this relationship, too, that develops between Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and Antonin Scalia from back in those days in a particular level of trust.
True, and it will go on for decades to come, and many years down the road in 2004 when Scalia goes duck hunting with Vice President Cheney at a time when the Vice President had a case before the Supreme Court dealing with his Energy Commission in the White House, Scalia is rather incredulous that people think that he should recuse himself, step down from that case, because he says, this is a friendship that I've had for so long, and so many other justices have had friendships with presidents. True enough, but they haven't had friendships with people who had cases then before the court.
You must wonder if one can be truly neutral in such cases.
Well, I don't think there was any doubt how he would come out in that case, but at least you have to have the appearance of propriety, and under that federal recusal rule that deals with whether or not a judge or a justice should step down, the standard is, would a reasonable person believe that you had an appearance of impropriety? And Scalia's argument in a 21-page memo was, if you think that I am improper here, you can't be reasonable, because no reasonable person that I know would think that this is an improper relationship.
Well, let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Bruce Allen Murphy, and we're talking about Scalia. That's the name of the book, Scalia, A Court of One, which is a rich biography about Antonin Scalia. While he was in the Nixon and Ford administration, a big part of his mission was derailing the Freedom of Information Act.
Yes, and he had a real difficulty with all of the leaks and all of the information that was going to the press from the Ford administration. And I think he developed an antipathy to the notion of private secret information, administrative information in Washington, eventually being available to the public through these outlets. So he was always trying to find a way to undermine the Freedom of Information Act and make it impossible for anyone to get that kind of information. One of the unique things that he came up with was there were exemptions and ways that you could get around the administration saying, we're not going to make this information available to you, even though you followed congressional law. And one of the exemptions was if the White House said this is part of their working papers, then they need to keep that secret, sort of an executive privilege kind of situation. So Scalia came up with the idea of putting remote White House operations in all of the different agencies where people would be trying to get information so that wherever you went for that information, you could say, oh, there's a White House operative there. I'm sorry, that information is in the exemption and you can't get it. You see this basic distrust of the press throughout Scalia's career. It's a curious relationship. He needs the press to be able to have them report on his speeches and report on his statements so that he can get the kind of attention that he's looking for. But he also keeps the press at arm's length and at times will exclude them from his activities because he can't control what they're going to say or do.
And it didn't seem like it was just the press, but any public information.
Yeah, he's not a fan of any public information, any secret information, any classified information getting out to the general public. He's very skeptical of the sort of democratic process by which people get transparency in their government so that they can vote the kinds of governors that they're seeking to get. He would much rather keep that information secret.
You wrote about how one of the people he fought was Ralph Nader at the time, and then he organized the CIA to help derail any advances with the Freedom of Information Act. Tell us what happened
in
these.
What Ralph Nader was trying to do was get information on the Ford pardon of Richard Nixon. He wanted to know what kind of deal, if any, was made before Nixon left the White House. And what Scalia was doing there was opposing Ralph Nader, but also he was very skilled because of his earlier positions in the Nixon and Ford administration at knowing which people to call in which agencies to get the result that he wanted. And so he was able to give individuals in various agencies, defense agencies and the CIA, the kind of information that they needed to keep their documents secret in spite of the Freedom of Information Act, and also to organize amongst themselves and try to lobby the White House to get Gerald Ford to not sign off on the amendment that would change the Freedom of Information Act and open things up further.
Did you ever get a sense of what he was really afraid of in this process? Like, why didn't he believe in open government?
You know, I got the sense that he knew what his role was. I think the process that he was learning is the process that you see now on the court. You give me an issue, I will find the central part of that issue. I will figure out where I want to go, and then I will figure out what information I need to marshal in order to justify the result that I've already decided on. And that seemed to be what he was doing in all of these positions. He was learning bits and pieces of how to use the bureaucracy, how to use legal argumentation, how to use political argumentation, how to balance out all of the interests so that he could lead the president and the administration where they wanted to go. He was there to serve the president, Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was in trouble. He was having trouble dealing with the press and Congress, and he was having trouble facing an election in 1976. His popularity continued to drop despite everything that he did because of what he had inherited from Richard Nixon. So I think Scalia is a very loyal individual, stayed until the very end of the Ford administration, even though it might have made it difficult for him to land in a different job. And in the process of trying to bolster the president, he learned how to be the Antonin Scalia we see now on the court.
President Carter comes into office. What does Antonin Scalia decide to do?
Well, very interesting, because what he decides to do is go out to Chicago. Most people, I think, would have stayed in Washington. And he flirted with that idea at Georgetown and being the law school. But he ended up going out to Chicago because he thought his money would stretch farther. He had a big family. They ended up living in an old fraternity house. And it would have given him a chance to figure out what to do next. So he had a foot in both worlds. He was teaching in Chicago, and he was also maintaining some of his connections in Washington. And as it turned out, it was another lucky turn in his life, because there were students out there who were beginning to put together what has become the Federalist Society. And they were working with a student at Yale where Robert Bork was teaching. And so you see sort of two camps that begin to arise, the Scalia camp among the conservatives and the Federalist Society, and then the Bork camp among the conservatives and the Federalist Society in Yale. And I think what happens is the beginnings of a sort of almost wariness and awareness that the next step in my career is going to have to be past Robert Bork, because Bork is better known at that point. He's been the Solicitor General. He was the man who fired Archibald Cox. He was the man who was mentioned for the seat that eventually went to John Paul Stevens. He's in the driver's seat for what will be a Supreme Court seat down the road. You want to get that seat, you've got to get past Robert Bork. And that leads us to, and I hope we get a chance to talk about it this week or next, his time on the Court of Appeals, where he gets to go side by side with Robert Bork.
Bruce Allen Murphy, we will look forward to learning more about that next week. Thank you so much for being with us this week.
My pleasure, Maria. I look forward to next week's conversation.
That is the first part of a two-part interview that we are doing with Bruce Allen Murphy about his new book, Scalia, A Court of One. We will continue the conversation next week. Meanwhile, when we come back, why violence is on the rise against women and what women are doing about it. Stay tuned.
Well, Bohemoth calls it his own, while the hammer wanders alone. They both go out to play on that cold and rainy. Bohemoth sings us his song, while Bahamut wanders along. But in the glory of this spring, you can hear Bahamut sing. Whoa, ho, ho, are you as big as me?
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Violence against women is on the rise in many parts of the world and present just about everywhere, according to our next guests. And in many of these places where women have historically had no recourse or power to end the violence, they formed their own institutions and organizations, many of them transnational. With us is Amana Fontanella Khan. She writes for Slate, The Daily Beast, and The New York Times, as well as the Christian Science Monitor. Her book is called Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women and Power in India. Manisha Desai also joins us. She is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and sociology at the University of Connecticut. She's the author of Gender and the Politics of Possibilities, Rethinking Globalization, and she's co-editor of Women's Activism and Globalization, Linking Local Struggle and Global Politics. Jackie True also joins us. She is professor of politics and international relations at Monash University. She is the author of The Political Economy of Violence Against Women and Gender, Globalization, and Post-Socialism. Welcome to the three of you. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with this piece that you have done here, Amana, in the New York Times called India's Feudal Rapists, where you discussed how the violence against women in India is really rooted in the caste system and really that it's acceptable to violate women of what was considered the lower caste. What is it like there?
It's always, when I'm speaking about India, important to issue a caveat, which is that it's a nation of, you know, 1 billion people, so it's impossible to make any generalizations. When I wrote the op-ed for the New York Times, I was really basing what I was saying on research that I did out in Uttar Pradesh, which is the state where the recent rape cases have happened. I spent 2 years, you know, going sort of back and forth to Uttar Pradesh and spending time in small villages where caste really is an inescapable element of daily, you know, society. I used to go to villages where sort of there were small little neighborhoods that were named after castes. And so you would only live in these neighborhoods if you belonged to XYZ caste. And I would meet people who were, you know, shunned from their communities for interacting with people of a lower caste. So yes, in this particular feudal caste-ridden, these sort of caste-ridden sort of areas of India, yes, there is a caste violence, and rape and gender violence are inextricable. The two are linked together in a very fundamental way.
So you open this op-ed piece with a distressed father whose daughter had disappeared. He called the police, but the first thing they asked is, what caste do you belong to? Is this normal?
I think that in the sort of village where this family is based, absolutely. Caste in a village like that would dictate everything from where you live to who you marry, what you eat, with who you eat, the job that you do. I mean, it literally defines every area of your life. So yes, it will also impact the kind of justice that you receive, the kind of attention that you receive from the police. And if you are of a lower caste to the police, then you're definitely going to experience discrimination.
So remind us of what happened. His daughter was missing. They did eventually find her. What happened to her, and how did the police respond?
It was two girls, cousins. Both were minors, and they had gone out to relieve themselves in the field. They are, like millions of Indians, without toilets in their homes. So they went out at night and they never returned. And a relative of the girls had spotted the two with some men from the village, and these men were up to no good. And the relative kind of confronted these individuals and had a gun pointed at him and was threatened. And obviously this relative then went back to the father and said, we've got a problem. It's important to alert the police as soon as possible. The girls had by that time still not returned. And so, as you said, when the father did go to the police, they just sort of turned him away. They actually, according to some newspaper reports, said, don't you worry, your daughter will turn up soon enough. Just look for her among the orchards. And the two girls were found hanging from a tree, in fact, just a few hours after.
Let's bring in Jackie True and Manisha Desai. Jackie True, let's start with you. Your book, The Political Economy of Violence Against Women, you said that violence against women is a major problem in all countries, affecting women really in every socioeconomic group and at every life stage. Can you put this into a context for us?
Well, that's quite a global statement, and I think that's great that you've quoted it, but I think the very next thing I say is, even though that's true, violence and the vulnerability to violence does affect particular groups of women more egregiously. And that has everything to do with the intersection of gender oppression with other forms of oppression, such as class, caste, ethnicity, sexuality, disability, and so on. So that it's not true to say that we're all affected in the same way. What I've been arguing is really complementary to Amina's argument, and that is to say that when women have lesser access to social and economic and cultural rights, they're much more likely to be in situations of vulnerability to violence. They're much more likely to be in precarious work, where they're subject to abuse and exploitation. They're much more likely to be in situations where they encounter intimate partner violence because they don't have rights to land, to property, to income, employment, all of those things that would make it easier, on the one hand, to escape violence, but on the other hand, to have a sense of status and a greater sort of bargaining power position within a relationship or within a family household. So that in the end, why women experience violence is not just because they have a vagina. It's actually because they're relatively powerless and unequal compared to men, and men in most groups, but this also relates to the kinds of other forms of oppression that women experience as members of ethnic minorities, as members of sexual minorities, and so on and so forth.
If you were going to give us a where we see this the most, where would you say it is? Is it conflict regions? Things that occurred, for example, in the Congo were just unspeakable.
Well, I think the other point that Amana makes in her New York Times article is about the role of the media in kind of playing up and sensationalizing some instances of violence. And that causes us to kind of deflect our attention to violence over there that's somehow not in our backyard or in our neighborhood. And I think that's quite problematic because I think most of the things that are happening in India are happening in my neighborhood, and that I actually have a responsibility to see the connections between the violence happening in my neighborhood and the violence happening in your neighborhood and Manisha's neighborhood, and that there is what feminist scholars talk about, a continuum of violence that women experience often and girls experience multiple forms of violence. One form leads to another, but also in very different contexts, they can experience also similar forms of sexual and gender-based violence. But I think the point is that some women are in situations that make it much more likely they're going to encounter violence and oppression. So that the notion that if all women of all social classes, for example, experience violence doesn't mean to say that women who experience poverty are much more likely to experience violence, and that violence itself has a further impact on marginalizing those women socially, economically, culturally. So I guess that would be the global perspective, and I'm a bit troubled by the media's fascination with places like Congo and India, with in particular events in those places, because I've actually seen some egregious cases of gang rape in my own society. Police ignored, people ignored, and then once they found out, there were huge protests. I think there are, I wouldn't want to say it's all the same or it's to the same extent or degree, but I think that if we start to look at recent events in the United States, when you're Santa Barbara, I think we can see the same kind of, I think what Amana talks about in her article, that the sense of entitlement of some men to some women. And I think we are experiencing that all over the world, and we're becoming much more aware of it. And I think what we need to do is become much more aware of the connections between these forms of violence in very different societies and contexts.
Manisha Desai, would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I'm glad, Jackie, that you mentioned that. What I was chomping at the bits here to say is, you know, the ways in which one tends to, the media in particular, tend to sensationalize violence that happens out there as opposed to in here. And so I think those connections are very important to make, particularly given the amount of sexual harassment on college campuses in the U.S. that have become really very big in the last few years. So yes, I think it is important to understand the connections across these different forms of violence that women experience in all parts of the world.
In all parts of the world, but perhaps, as you said earlier, Jackie, true, not to the same degree.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So perhaps that's something that we should distinguish.
Well, I think we can make distinctions. You know, for example, if we just look at some of the data that we do have, for example, the World Health Organization's prevalence survey on domestic violence and sexual violence in 48 countries, we can see very high prevalence regions or areas and countries and medium to high. But they're all quite high. So it's not a question of it's a problem there and not here. It's really a question of gradation. For example, in Australia, I mean, we know that one woman every week is murdered by her partner. That's pretty shocking. We know that on average, globally, there's a 35% prevalence rate of violence against women. That means that 35% of women will experience a serious incident or pattern of violence in their lifetime. There's more than one in three. It can vary between 20% and 60% of a society. I think we still need to understand the magnitude of that violence really everywhere.
Amana Fontanelli Khan.
In the case of India, it's actually, the media has played quite an instrumental role in breaking the taboo around rape and reporting rape, and also just really putting this issue on the agenda. Gang rapes, horrific crimes against women, happened before the Delhi gang rape of 2012. But it was because of the protest movement that happened in India and the extensive media coverage that followed that, that really drew the nation's attention to the problem, and then also, sure, international attention. But, you know, I don't think that the attention was hyped in any way, at least not in the case of India. I think it was really a grassroots kind of a movement. You know, you speak to people who are working in this field of women's empowerment in India, and they're on the whole very grateful to the involvement of the press.
If I may just add that, in fact, you know, the contemporary women's movement in India started with a rape of an Adivasi, which is an indigenous girl, you know, back in 1980. And in some ways, at the time, a lot of women's activists and feminists who were part of the media that made it possible for the media to focus on that. And I think the current focus on media is actually quite different. Even in India, and while there is a very strong feminist movement, a lot of the feminists themselves are kind of concerned with the kind of coverage that happens. So there's also responses within India after the rape of Nirbhaya, which was name given to the woman who died after the 2012 rape, was a kind of very extremely violent responses to that. So in some ways kind of undermine the feminist and the women's movement articulation of rape and violence to sort of then the response being, okay, let's pass a rape law that's very restrictive or a rape law, you know, and sort of bringing out a lot of nationalist and chauvinistic kind of responses. So the current media focus on rape in India is sort of more complicated and I think troubling to a lot of feminists and women's groups in India itself.
Let's talk about the movement just a little bit, because this is part of what your book was about, Amana, was about this one particular pink gang that developed in India.
My book is about a women's group called the Gulabi Gang, which is a pink gang in English. They're a group of around 20,000 women that are based in the state of Uttar Pradesh, where these recent rapes happened. The gang was founded by a woman called Sampat Pal, who was married off at the age of 12, had the first of her five children at 15. She comes from a relatively lower caste, and she experienced many of the kind of feudal kind of discriminations that one does living in a small village in Uttar Pradesh. And she and the women in her gang have, you know, decided to fight back. They've all donned these pink sari uniforms. They carry pink sticks and they fight against men who abuse their wives and they take on corrupt politicians and crooked police. I think that their story is very important because one thing that I have felt was problematic about the coverage is that very often, you know, women are portrayed as merely victims, women who are just raped and violated and but who are just passively receiving this violence instead of actually, you know, being actors and exercising some kind of agency in a response to the violence. And these, the women that I wrote about, do precisely that. Many of them have experienced marital rape and gang rape even, but they're fighting back. And I think this is very important, you know, to recognize that there are women across India who are really taking a stand and doing something to change the situation.
Are they in this particular pink gang across caste as well, or are they primarily of one or two castes?
They're predominantly lower caste. They're not all Dalits, so they're not all from the very, very lowest caste. But on the whole, these women are poor, they're illiterate, they are landless agricultural workers. They're sort of the dispossessed. And the reason that they are essentially joining this, you know, sort of vigilante organization is because they just do not think that the justice system responds to their needs.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about violence against women and what women are doing about it. Manisha Desai, you've been looking transnationally how women are organizing across the globe.
And I think just like the Gulabi Gang, I think what's important to realize, particularly for a lot of, the Global South, is that the kind of organizing that happens in the West doesn't necessarily reach, whether it's through the legal aid or, you know, shelters or various other kinds of services that we are more used to in the Global North. And so, for example, in India and elsewhere, there also actually started in Morocco, women's courts, and these are women from poor communities, primarily in urban areas, you know, within slums, who've organized to essentially form their own kind of court to monitor violence and to bring to justice men who, you know, perpetrate violence against women. So they essentially train women from the communities, and there's a hearing. They bring together the person and the families, because very often women don't have the option to leave in a situations of abuse, and so the focus has been to involve the men and families who engage in such violence to essentially, you know, write a contract, and then the paralegals who are trained to essentially monitor what happens in this family. You know, that's one example of the ways in which poor women, particularly in urban areas, who don't have access to law and to other services, are kind of organizing themselves to, you know, address issues of violence that happens within their homes and, you know, within their communities.
Manisha Desai, in one of your edited volumes, there were some Latin American examples as mm-hmm. well. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, these were groups that had actually been using radio, community radio, as well as actually computer centers, community computer centers to bring together. Because what they found was that these computer centers within telecenters in their communities were essentially being used by young men to really look at pornography, rather than what they were meant to be used for was for literacy in other areas. And so once women began to see that, they organized and actually brought those young men to really task for the kind of work they were doing. So there's been a lot of organizing, and this is happening particularly in Peru and then in Ecuador as well. There were women who had organized locally through various kinds of women's movements to deal with issues of violence against women. And, of course, currently both in Peru and other places, through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, particularly in Peru around the Sandino Luminoso, the guerrilla warfare and the violence and rape that was committed through that, there's, you know, a lot of work being done there too. So I think in a lot of different communities around, you know, the world, women have been organizing locally, you know, using other NGOs and women's movements to address these kind of issues.
Jackie True, you've also been tracking some of these transnational networks.
I think these local movements that Manisha is speaking about have been empowered by a broader global movement to recognize violence against women as violence. And, you know, that begins, I guess, with the United Nations Declaration in 1993, coming off the Conference on Human Rights, where women's human rights were recognized. And I think now we've sort of got awareness that there are all these forms of violence that have gone under the radar, that have been quite silent and have been committed very often in the private sphere. But I think now what we need to do is really to understand the root causes of the violence globally, and to be able to also have a framework that kind of helps us to understand the connections between, you know, forms of violence happening in different regions and different localities. One of the things I think we might do there is to look at the impact of transformations in the global economy with respect to the increasing competition for cheap labor and for, you know, states to attract investment, and increasingly also through promoting women's participation in the labor market. And I think that there is a connection between what you might say is the feminization of the labor market and the increasing exploitation of women, and also the empowerment of women by changing economic processes, and also the violence they're encountering as well. And I think there's some very interesting research which shows that whilst I think that when women have a good economic and social status, they're much less likely to be vulnerable to violence, men's violence, that it is true that we see new forms of violence occurring, especially in middle-income countries where women's status is rising, partly due to changing social and economic conditions. When women take up employment, for example, made possible by the opening of global markets, and that this newfound status actually leads to a backlash from men in their families, in their communities, who feel they have lost their entitlement to power, to jobs. I think this is an area that we need much more research on. We need to understand, you know, I mean, I think those who've worked, for example, on microfinance and how women have benefited through kind of collective loans, and how that actually may also lead to a backlash in family where men also seek to control those new funds and that new wealth. I think that research shows that it's a kind of a complex gendered dynamic. And I think that we also need to understand the relationship between changing, you know, global economic and social relations and changing gender relations and violence, because they don't, you know, it's not as if we empower all women politically and economically, not that that's an easy task, that somehow violence will go away, because it is about the contestation over power.
Amana Fontanella Khan, you wrote about moral blind spots that are there partly because people have been embedded in this structure for so long that it's sort of the way it is.
As we've discussed, violence against women emerges out of structural inequality, the weakness of women vis-a-vis men. And so in a system like the caste system, which is so clearly hierarchical, and where inequality is within the DNA of the caste system, it's very clear that this will create a situation where violence against women becomes permissible, and where once you have a system where you're not seeing your fellow man or fellow woman as an equal, then their pain, their violence that is committed against them, just simply does not resonate in the same way that violence against someone of your own position would. And I think in the time that I spent out in India, and in particularly in the small villages in Uttar Pradesh, it was just very evident that the lower castes were exposed to violence at a much larger degree because they were just simply not seen, as being worth as much as someone of the upper caste.
Jackie True, these blind spots, yeah. I want to get into how we transcend them. Moral blind spots that people don't even consider that they're doing something that is violent, perhaps. At the same time, we're seeing some advancement of women into political power positions. Does that make a difference?
I think it's a very good point that how we understand and what we see as violence and how we understand it is really different across societies. But I think increasingly with these global frameworks and definitions, I think that's really helpful to activists in kind of really using a kind of a benchmark to, or a light to shine upon these practices and to show that they are, if not illegal, then abhorrent to most of the people in the world. In terms of, women's participation in politics and their representation in parliaments and legislatures and leadership, I think it can make a huge difference. But of course, I think one of the trends we're seeing is because when women take up those positions, they are also, gaining access to power. And I think some of the new forms of violence we're seeing is where violence is really explicitly targeted at political women, at women seeking political positions, and women who are human rights defenders of women and men's human rights. And I think this is quite a deliberate and conscious attempt in many instances, and often in relation to the group that women represent, which is not just women, but it could be also their ethnic or class group, but it is an attempt to diminish that power and to resist the transformation of power in a more gender equal way. So again, I don't see that there's this kind of a gradual advance where women will become equal with men. It's a struggle, and it's a struggle in every place. And I think we can start to see, especially in the Asia Pacific, where we have, though it's the largest global region, we have actually the lowest, perhaps if we also encompass the Middle East, some of the lowest rates of participation and representation of women in the world. And that where women have kind of achieved leadership roles, it's typically through their connections with male relatives. But I think there is a connection there, because I think the more that we push to have women's voices heard in the public space, the more they are able to kind of raise these issues, and kind of name violence and gendered violence as a problem.
Well, I think it's important that which women are we talking about, which women come to power, because I think women are not a homogeneous group, and depending on their, class and caste and race affiliations, the kind of issues they're going to bring into conversation will also be different. And in fact, there was just a study done, for example, India has 33% of women's participation in local election councils. And a lot of them, so, you know, you have now over 2 million women in various local villages in power through various villages in India, and yet most of their power is wielded by the men in the families or men in the communities. So again, just having women in political power, you know, it's one step, but how women are brought into power and who the women are also makes a big difference to the kind of issues that they're going to raise.
I think I would say just one thing. If we were just to kind of look at the big, I completely agree with Manisha's point, but if we were to just look at the big picture, we would see that, of course, there is a relationship between women's increasing political voice, whether that's through formal representation or through the presence of transnational feminist movements, and the attention to violence against women, the laws passed aiming to protect and prevent that violence, and also the global media attention to the problem of violence against women.
I think that that has more to do with the women's movements all around the world rather than just women in power.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we need to see, when I talk about women's political voice, I mean, part of that is, of course, women's movement, political voice.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Amana Fontanella Khan, Manisha Desai, and Jackie True. It's a great pleasure hosting you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amana Fontanella Khan writes for Slate, The Daily Beast, and The New York Times, as well as the Christian Science Monitor. Her book is called Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women and Power in India. Manisha Desai is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and sociology at the University of Connecticut. She's the author of Gender and the Politics of Possibilities, Rethinking Globalization, and she's co-editor of Women's Activism and Globalization, Linking Local Struggle and Global Politics. Jackie True is professor of politics and international relations at Monash University. She is the author of The Political Economy of Violence Against Women and Gender, Globalization, and Post-Socialism. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian. Lay your